Thank you, ladies. It's I hope that because of Mr. Bedge's comments, you weren't reflecting about football statistics in that piece, but you were reflecting on the color. The music had great color to it, didn't it? Of God's involvement in your life. Well, it's good afternoon. Nice to be with all of you. Look at the sunlight coming in through the stained glass. It's really kind of neat this time of year. Yeah. So those of you on this side get to see that. Those of you on this side don't see the light streaming in. But so I would like to talk about James chapter 3. We have a handout for you today because I've got some Greek words to go through. And the reason I want to talk about them is I think as we delve in and dig in a little deeper, this set of scriptures is very instructive to us, engaging and motivating for us to understand how God's knowledge and word and wisdom and spirit can be active in our lives. So if you would turn over with me to James chapter 3, we see two kinds of wisdom. Two kinds of wisdom are portrayed in the last portions of James chapter 3. But what is wisdom? Merriam-Webster's dictionary says that wisdom is knowledge that is gained by having many experiences in life. A second definition is the natural ability, seemingly, that some people have to connect with knowledge and understand what its consequences are before they have to do it. And often we'll say he's wise or she is wise beyond their years. Because what? They understand if they do A, B, and C, D is what happens. And thus they are considered wise because they don't take knowledge and have to acquire it only for themselves. Or there's the other type of knowledge that is based on proper, reasonable, good sense judgment. So when we apply knowledge well, it's considered wisdom. When we apply knowledge not so good, it's called the school of hard knocks, and we just feel stupid, right? But we want to talk about wisdom from above. Notice James chapter 3, verses 13 and 14. 13 talks to us and says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom," reflecting that there's a good type of wisdom. But notice over in verse 14, it says, "But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts and do not boast and lie against the truth, this wisdom," meaning this wisdom that is envious and self-seeking, that's boastful, that lies, "does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic." We don't think of there being good wisdom and evil wisdom. Clearly, James is saying that there is a way in which you can act that is considered wise, but it's evil, he says in this verse 15. It's sensual. It's demonic. So there is knowledge that if we apply it, gives you bad wisdom. But we want to talk about today is the type of wisdom that is reflected in verse 13 that is good wisdom, that is sown and done in meekness and fear. So let's read through on verse 16. "For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there." That's where the worldly wisdom, the wisdom that comes from evil side, is. But, in verse 17, "But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, and then it's peaceable, it's gentle, it's willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits. It is without partiality, without hypocrisy." And that's the verse that we need, and I would like to take apart today. You know, wisdom in the Greek is the word Sophia. You know, every once in a while you'll run into a lady whose name, usually who are Greek, or their names are Sophia. I was in Greece a few months ago, and the lady we were working with, her name was Sophia. It means wisdom. But wisdom is, let's be clear, when we get knowledge from the good wisdom from God, then what happens? If we apply that knowledge well, it's considered wisdom, and we would classify it here as wisdom from above. Thayer's Greek lexicon talks about wisdom, Sophia, and it says the following. It says, "Wisdom is broad and full intelligence. It is used of the knowledge of very diverse matters. so that the shade of the meaning in which the word is taken must always be discovered from the context in the particular case. Meaning, all that you can get out of wisdom always is shaped, just like we heard in the music today. The flute, the higher registers and the lower registers had different color. And then Mrs. Russell, actually the composer, would toss the melody over to Mrs. Roybal on the piano. And it would have a different color and a different richness. And then it would come back in a different... This is what wisdom does. You have to take knowledge. You know what I mean? If you know knowledge, okay, and you apply the same knowledge to fix a bicycle, to fix your computer, it may not translate. You know what I mean? You may have the hammer set out and the crescent wrench, and you come over here into the tool in the computer, and it's not the same tools, right? You hammer and big screwdrivers on computers mean what? You're destroying the hard drive. Right? But over here on a car or something, you may be nuancing something. You may be getting something untightened so you can fix something. So we see in Thayer's Greek lexicon that Sophia in the Bible actually comes to have five types of wisdom. Five types of wisdom. In the Bible, we see there is a wisdom that seems to come from God, meaning knowledge from God that is well applied is considered wisdom from God. Some scriptures, there's wisdom that comes from Christ. There is spiritual things. Wisdom is applied to spiritual concepts often. And sometimes wisdom is applied to the natural world, the natural sphere of things. And as we saw in verses 15, 14, and 15, 16, there is a wisdom that refers to debased thinking, the knowledge applied in a debased, in a deprived, in a selfish, in a boastful, envious, and here it says in James chapter 3, verse 15, demonic way. But I want to talk about this wisdom that comes from love. What we do with the knowledge that comes from God, and thus we see something, I think, wonderful. Wonderful about how we can sow and have wisdom from above in our lives and in our every thought. So in this verse, in verse 17, it says, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure. First. In the Greek, you see, is main. And it means truly, certainly, indeed. It's a participle of affirmation. Meaning something has to come first before you can have wisdom from above. First. We must pause and see what it says. It must be first. What is it? First, it's pure. The Greek word here, if you see on the page, is hagnos. It means that reverence. It's existing. It's venerable. It's something that is sacred. You must have something first in your life and my life that is sacred. Vines goes on to talk about this and says it is something that is chaste. It is pure from every fault. When do we talk about pure here? It is sincere. We must have a purity, a sincerity to have access to the knowledge of God and thus apply it rightly and thus it to be classified as wisdom from above. You know, over in 2 Corinthians 7 is a nice reference to how this same word is used, hagnos. In verses 10 and 11, it says, for godly sorrow produces repentance leading to salvation, not to be regretted, but the sorrow of the world produces death. Verse 11, for observe this very thing, that you sorrowed in a godly manner. What diligence is produced in you? What clearing of yourselves? What indignation? What fear? What vehement desire? What zeal and what vindication? In all these things, you proved yourself to be clear. Hagnos. The word here, clear, is hagnos. It is the same word of purity. The same word of pure from James. In this, to be clear in this matter. Brethren, how did we become clear, pure, hagnos in God's sight? through the acceptance of Jesus Christ, through the forgiveness of sin. Our conscience is cleansed, our sins are forgiven. And so James is saying, first, you must go from this place of purity. First, mene hagnos, you must have this purity to be able to partake of the knowledge and thus apply it and thus have wisdom from above. Barnes Notes makes this comment. It says, with respect to hagnos, it says, the meaning here is that the first and immediate effect of religion is not on your intellect. It is not to make you more enlightened or more imaginative. It is not to make you brilliant. It is not to improve your memory or your judgment, but to make them clearer and stronger through the absence of sin. It is the purity of the heart, the purity of the heart, here to make a man upright, a woman inoffensive, and thus people good. If we want to be good people, we have to be pure people. To be pure people, we must be free of sin, and God is the one who grants that. And from that place, first of pure, of clearness, we now can look and ask for the knowledge of God, and thus what? We can have wisdom from above because we begin to apply it in a way that we could not before the clearing. Before the water is clear, we can't do this. And so he says, this purification needs to take place. This is what God grants us through his Spirit. Therefore, it is from this place we can sow the knowledge, and thus we can reap something. Notice how it says in verse 18 of James chapter 3, it says, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. We must use our place of purity to sow something and thus reap something. God intends for our lives to grow, to blossom, and thus the wisdom, the knowledge as it's applied, is seen as wisdom that comes from above. But my friends, it's actually worked for, moment by moment, and thought by thought, and that's why James, in chapter 3, verse 17, refers to these other words. Now, the next four words are rather interesting. So we see that it is mene hagnos, first pure, and then we talk about what are the attributes. It says, then it's peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, and full of mercy. If you saw it in the Greek, look down your page. The four Greek words all begin with E. It's almost like a poem. You know, if we saw this in music, if we saw it in lyrics, if we saw it in something, we would get the comprehension of how it would lay on your memory forever. The words we have to use in English, then peaceable, gentle, willingness to yield, and full of mercy, is like, you know, some days we'll remember and some days we won't. But if you saw it in the Greek and you saw that it was epitat, right, and you would see it being eran ekos, and then you would see it as epikas, and then you would see eupithes, you would see it in your mind, and you would see these four words mean how this works. And notice, let's get into it. It says then, in the Greek it's epitat, afterwards, thereupon. Meaning, so if you're first pure, now what? Now something can happen. The then is there. You can't get to that stage without the first. You see how it said first pure, but then something happens. Then it's possible. We must stand on this. We bank everything on it. Okay? We bank everything on the power of God to forgive our sin, our affront to him. And when we do, that cleanses, that purity, gives us a place from which to sow, to reap, to apply knowledge, and thus it would be called wisdom from above. So notice it says it's peaceable. Now this Greek word for peaceable, aranikos, is very fascinating. As you see there, it means to relate to peace, the arts of peace, the arts of peace. You know, we talk about sometimes things being the arts and letters at a college. You know, you'll see that phrase. In everyday life, we don't talk about things in that way. Bringing peace. Bringing peace. Are you bringing peace wherever you go? I hearken back several years ago when Mr. Helge was commenting about the passing of Mr. D. Barapardian, and Mr. Helge's small epithet was, Mr. D-Bar party and left a very small wake in life. He went through, but you know, after he left, there wasn't a lot of churn when he left the room. What a wonderful attribute. You see what I mean? And that's what he's saying to here. Peace, this arenikos that comes, that is something that we must bring with us. It comes with our purity. We must sow it. We must seek for it. You know, in Vines, I brought it up for you. It says, it is the fruit of a righteousness because it is produced not by itself, but in communion with God. I love that phrase. It is produced in communion with God. You see, because of the purity, we now get to exist with God. You know, we get to talk with Him. We get to be with Him. We get to have Him reflect our thoughts and ideas, and we begin to talk Him through. And He begins to talk us through how this all works. You know, in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 11, there's an interesting phrase, the way it's applied over there. This same word is used. Aranikos, chapter 12, verse 11, it says, "Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who are trained by it." You see, when we bring peace with us, when we seek peace, what happens? We are sowing something and it follows. A process happens. And then a person says, well, it's like they have wisdom from above, because what they're sowing and they're bringing a peace. It's something they see that needs to be done. I don't know whether any of you have, you know, but 2 weeks ago, and we don't see it much of it in the news in the last week, but 2 weeks ago, and for the few 4 or 5 weeks and maybe months before that, there's been a great story over here in Hollywood being played out. And it is the Viacom National Amusements Corporation story. Okay? There's this guy named Sumner Redstone, okay, who owns through his company, National Amusements, 80% of the Viacom stock. Viacom is a mega, 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 mega gazillion media company, okay? Viacom owns Paramount Pictures. I mean, we can't even name what Viacom owns, okay? Viacom owns CBS. Okay? Did you ever see those ads, those billboards on the freeway, some of them? Look underneath. It says CBS Viacom. They own tons of media stuff. But they've got a big, big, this is going to be a movie someday. And what's fascinating is Mr. Sumner Redstone, about last year sometimes, kicked two caretakers, one somebody who took after his health and somebody else who was basically another a living companion in the house. He kicks them out of the house. He's 94 years old. And he now his daughter comes back into the picture, who Mr. Redstone has been very dismissive of over the years. Even though she has quite a good business acumen, he would publicly ridicule this daughter. And yet she comes back into his life and brings the family back in and grandchildren and tries to repair his life. And so in the process of this, Mr. Redstone decides that Mr. Philippe Daum, D-A-U-M, the president and CEO of Viacom, should be removed because he's not giving enough shareholder value back. And Mr. Daum has been a confidant of Mr. Redstone for 30-some years. I mean, there's been a big work at play here, okay? And Miss Sherry Redstone, daughter, comes along with National Amusements, the parent company, and she dismisses Mr. Daum. And Mr. Redstone gives his support from his little bed over here in Bel Air. And there's a big court battle, and is he sane and is he not sane? And there's just lawyers and lawyers. So Mr. Daum and another gentleman who's also on the board, who were appointed both to both boards, who are now being removed, sue, one of them in New Jersey and one of them in Massachusetts. Okay? I mean, this is a fight of all fights. Bevy of lawyers. Can you get it? I mean, everybody's going to be at war with everybody for as long as the money will last, and Mr. Redstone's got plenty of it. Last, 2 weeks ago Thursday, the Wall Street Journal front page says there was a conference call yesterday, Thursday, and it says on the conference call, Mr. Philippe Daum agreed that he would step aside as chairman, and he said, "Miss Redstone, may I thank you and the family for the opportunity to have served in National Amusement in Mr. Redstone's immediate working place for all these years. I've learned so much, and thank you." And she, it says, reported in the phone call, sows some peace. And she says, "We too would like to thank you. Despite our differences, we think we have always been able to communicate and move along in a productive way." Why would these two seemingly great adversaries come and sow peace on a conference call? I submit to you, maybe they think they might need each other someday. Whatever it could be, they saw some need to sow some peace and thus dismiss bevies of lawyers. And the payout for Mr. Dahm was not too bad. But I mean, you see what I'm saying? Sometimes we think at all cost we must hold to our superior and maybe rightful position. They found room to sow some polite words of peace to each other. Fascinating. If we look around, do we see an opportunity to sow peace? The next word here, it says, then it is gentle. Gentle, epikos. Now this word, it means suitable. It means fair. It means mild. We need to be fair. We need to be... Now mild, okay? Mild is like having, to me, like having toast without jelly. Is that what he's saying, that we should be toast without jelly? Mild? No, we're talking about approaches to other people. It is suitable. We must be seen as being equitable. You know what I mean? We must understand how this means. In the Greek, do you see what the word, notice how it literally has epi, ikos. Notice, what do we do, epi? Everybody in this new room, and there's a big thing about in the country right now about a manufacturer of epi pens who's overcharging, and now it's going to undercharge, and now it's going to give you a credit if you didn't get it, blah, blah, blah. But epi means what? It means intense. When somebody's about to extinguish, they put that epi pen in their thigh and bang! It's called intensity overload, and they're back to life, right? The allergic is gone, okay? Now, so if I did not bring up this word and I said to you, the wisdom that comes from above is first pure, and then it's peaceable, and then it's gentle, and then it's mild. The word gentle in English does not convey the depth of the meaning in Greek at all. In our day and age, gentle means gentle. Gentle here means epi. It literally means to have an intensity that is able to be reasoned with. Vines, I said there, uses it is intensely reasonable. Intensely reasonable. Intensely able to be reasoned with. That's what it means to be gentle. Merriam-Webster's dictionary talks about reasonable. And it says reasonable is something that is not extreme, excessive, it is moderate, it is fair, we get that, is having the faculty of reason. When we think about this word here, and we have to have knowledge that comes from above, how we apply it is intensely reasonable. Now, the synonym for this is logical in our society. Philippians chapter 4, verse 5, Philippians 4, verse 5, I'll give you a quick reference. We see it used in another way. It says, let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. It's the same word. Let your epikos be known to all men. Let your intense reasonableness. Changes Philippians 4 verse 5, doesn't it? You're intensely able to be reasoned with. Barnes' note says this. It means a gentleness of spirit, of deportment and manners. And everyone that can see that has the appropriate spirit of religion. It is from this word that we have derived the word gentleman. Now, Barnes' notes was written quite a while ago. Barnes' note says that this is what a gentleman is. Today we don't use the term. We say everybody's a gentleman. There was a time when you didn't call somebody a gentleman unless you knew of their character. Unless you knew how they deported themselves, meaning how they mannerisms themselves, how they treated people of various stations in life, and how they could see their way through to be reasoned with and to reason with others. That is the depth of this meaning. You know, Merriam-Webster's dictionary talks about gentle, and it says having or showing a kind and quiet nature, not being harsh nor violent. But Vines goes on and say, the effect of true religion is to make everyone, in the proper and the best sense of the word, a gentle person, an intensely reasonable person. I was trying to figure out what would be a good biblical example for this. And I'm not sure I've got the perfect one, but it's Matthew chapter 15. And in Matthew chapter 15, because I was trying to think about how we would all agree that Christ was, had all these qualities. And we would agree that we would think that Jesus Christ exemplified being a gentle person, a highly reasonable person. And I think this situation in Matthew chapter 15, verses 1 through 6, explains it well. It says, the scribes and the Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to him. And they said, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. And he answered and said to them, why do you also transgress the commandment of God? Because of your tradition. For God commanded, saying, honor your father and mother, and he who curses your father and mother, let him be put to death. In verse 5, but you say, whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is now a gift to God. And verse 6, then he need not honor his father and mother. Thus you have made the commandments of God of no effect by your tradition. The New Living Translation says in verse 6, and it closes, and it says, and so you cancel out the word of God for the sake of your own tradition. You see, Jesus was not rolling over and playing dead. That's not what gentle means. Gentle does not mean, in the English, as it's translated from, epikos, right, to be gentle person, to be full of gentleness, is to be intensely reasonable. It does not mean, oh, you wanted to overcharge me for the car you're renting to me? Oh, yeah, okay, bring it on. No. The ability to reason with, the ability to have a discussion. Jesus said, oh, you want to talk about the law and tradition? Okay, I'll talk to you about the law and tradition. By the way, you're raking in the money that belongs to your parents for their good care, and you're claiming that is a higher tradition and that that person is justified. And I tell you, it's not true. Jesus took the very argument they brought, the very discussion point, and he brought it back around to why. Now, I have a comment for you. Oftentimes, I think we love to see that Jesus got him, right? Jesus got, oh, yeah, he put him in their place. Was Jesus replying to get them, or was Jesus replying to get them? Was Jesus trying to get their hearts, minds, and souls? Was Jesus trying to see if they would get the point? You see, Jesus, I'd submit to you, we often read too much of the end result, that he's just grinding in his point, when he's trying to really bring it out, reflect it in a different way, so that maybe they'll see that they're wrong. Is that how we use our gentleness, our ability to sow peace, our ability to discuss and think and reason, to become reasonable in an incredibly intense way? I found this word absolutely fascinating, as you could tell. And I just thought, the word gentle, I won't think about it in the same way. But epi, to be intensely reasonable. Now, this means also, if we go back over to James chapter 3, that it is intensely reasonable after you're being sowing peace, and now you're willing to yield. Some translations use easily to be entreated. Eupithes, this word in Greek, it means easily obeying, compliant, ready to obey, well, persuaded. The implication of this word is a willingness to yield to God and man where appropriate. But the implication is that yieldingness comes from God. You see, the yieldingness should come from God because if then we are pure, hagnos, mene hagnos, right? If we're pure from that place of safety, you see, there's no safer place in life than when you know you're wrong and that you know God has the power to forgive you and now you're back. It's like you're on home base. It's like we're okay, fine. The world and everything is going to be swirling, whatever. But for this place, I'm safe because from here, God says that I'm pure. And from this place, God, now I want to pray for this person. I want to ask for this. I want to see how to apply this knowledge. How do I sow peace? How do I find it? How do I apply it? And thus it looks in the end like, wow, they have wisdom from above. You know, Barnes Notes makes a comment about this verse, and it says, it means it's easily persuaded and compliant. Of course, this refers only to cases where it is right and proper to be easily and persuaded. You know, we're not easily persuaded when somebody says, oh, by the way, it doesn't matter which day of the week you keep. Sorry, you've run up against the Word of God. Right? This verse is not about us being milquetoast. This verse is about how rich we are, like the music we heard today, how the music can be passed back and forth, how it goes from highs to lows. This is about how you and I use the Spirit of God with the foundation of purity. Because then you see we have God's backing. And from that strength, much can be sown and much can be reaped. Barnes goes on to say, it cannot, this word, easily to be entreated, willing to yield, okay? It cannot refer to things which are in themselves wrong. The sense is that he who is under the influence of wisdom, which is from above, is not stiff, stern, obstinate, unyielding. He does not take a position and then hold it, whether right or wrong, we've always done it this way. If we've always done it that way, then can't we reasonably bring others to see the rightness of that cause, the rightness of that logic, the soundness of what? That position? Yes, that's how you become a gentle person, a person willing to what? To be reasonable and to reason with others. It says here, he or she is not a person on whom no argument or persuasion can have any influence. You know, Downton Abbey, when they come and say, well, you think Father will hear this thing? And they go and, oh, no, we've always done it this way. Since 1772, we've done it this way. How's that working for you? The farm is bankrupt right now. Maybe we got to try something else. You know what I mean? Can an argument have an influence? He is not one who cannot be affected by any appeal which might be made to him on the grounds of patriotism, justice, and benevolence. How do we get through to the quarterback in San Francisco who won't stand to the national anthem? Somebody needs to go who's reasonable with and reason with this gentleman, and help him see there are other ways to get your point across. How do you reason with somebody who is what? Being, you and I would consider, unpatriotic. Does he have challenges with the way he thinks things are run? Yes, and I do too. Where does the line stand? Where is it that we stand together, you see? There has to be a place, just as we can't sow these elements apart from God. We can't sow these things by saying, it's my way or the highway. No, we sow them. We practice them. We abide in them and we reap their blessings from being in that place of purity with God. And then things can go forward. And that's what it's incumbent upon us to realize. The implication is that all these things, this willingness to yield, comes from above. But he is one who is ready to yield when truth requires him to do it, and who is willing to sacrifice his own convenience for the good of others. One of the best applications for this we've seen in the last decade or so in our own community is when we had Growing Kids God's Way. And it resonated with many of us when we realized, we said, we gave our children the opportunity to appeal. We always go to bed at 8:30, right? That's the household rule. We go to bed at 8:30. Well, Mom, Dad, could I bring up something about the 8:30 rule this Saturday night? A parent who is willing to yield says, okay, what is it? And he in the lesson said, what? He said the children were compelled or encouraged to use the word appeal. I have an appeal. It's a nice word. You know what I mean? It's okay, fine. I want to appeal. Appeal means you've got the power. We all love to keep the power, right? You know, we don't want to give any power, okay? I want to appeal. And when I appeal, now I get to make my case. And we say, well, you know, the movie's on. And it is, after all, Battlestar Galactica number 3, Dad, your absolute favorite. And wouldn't you love your favorite daughter to sit with you and watch Battlestar Galactica 3? It'd be a real family affair, right? It worked. It works. There is a place for appeal. There must be a place for appeal in your and I, hearts and minds, in our family and in our church community, and in our lives and our workplaces. This is how, when it says this person's gentleness is known to all people, our ability to be intensely reasonable, fair to yielding, understanding how to bring forward the point and the cause for others. You know, a friend who's always trying to do better at things, and he introduced me to a book that I'm listening to on tape, and it's entitled by Chris Voss, and it's Never Split the Difference. And one of the things that struck me, and I think it applies here, you see, Mr. Voss, in his topic of how negotiations are done, he says, are you always just trying to solve the problem, or are you seeing the opportunity to move the people? And I think what you see, hearkening back to Mr. Zajac's sermonette, is God is always looking for the opportunity to move the people. And sometimes you and I have to be willing to get out of the way to let the people by. You know, that's what happens with us as parents, right? Mr. Budge is talking about being an empty nester. You have to say, okay, fine, I'm going to move aside and let them move out. Let them go to college. Let them stay up too late. Let them fail an exam or two. You know what I mean? No, we aren't around to catch them all the time. I mean, it's a challenge for a parent, right? We've been there. We've done all those things, and now we're going to watch them go and do things. It's fun. It's exciting. It's scary as all get out. But it's the process. We're willing to watch it happen. And thus, these young people move themselves to places where they can be movers and sowers and partake of the purity that comes from knowing God, and sow peace too. Sow yieldedness, become gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy. Full of mercy. I put down the word for full because mestos refers to people whose minds are, as it were, filled with the thoughts and emotions, either good or bad. Brethren, we can be full of all kinds of things. Which are they going to be? They're going to be the good things or the bad things. And that's what James is talking about. Are we full of wisdom of the world? Wisdom that's demonic and envious, that's boastful, that's selfish. You know, you look back over to those words. Wisdom that does not descend from above is earthly, it's sensual, it's demonic. Notice in verse 14, it boasts, it lies against the truth, it seeks, self-seeks its own way. Verse 16, where it's envious, it's self-seeking, it's confusion, and everything that comes from that. And that's why we go back to, God, get me out of the way and watch this come. So now what it seems that we, as we sow these things, we become full of mercy. Elios means is in the outward manifestations of pity. It assumes the need on the part of him who receives it. Do we think sometimes people need mercy? It's in our power, it's in our grasp, it's in our purview to extend that mercy because they might really, really need it. They might really need the benefit of the doubt. That is how we become to be looked. It is a resource that is adequate to meet the need on the part of him who shows it. You think about that? I thought about that sometimes. You know, only if I'm in touch with God, only if I'm in that place of purity, do I have the capacity to extend a mercy which is not human. That mercy is not self-seeking, and it's not boastful, it's not envious. It's only then that I can extend the mercy that that person really needs. But maybe in a sense it doesn't come from me because it just flows through me because I allow it to just go. I don't filter it. I'll take off 10% because they're not quite contrite enough. You know what I mean? We want to trim, but that's not how we gain it if we keep a little off. You know, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3, it says, God is the Father of all mercy. One of his titles is the Father of Mercy. And in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, his abundant mercy, he has begotten us again to a living hope. Peter says, through mercy, we have living hope. Through mercy, we get to partake of that place of purity, and then thus we get to what? We begin to have peaceable. We're gentle. We're willing to yield. We're full of mercy and good fruits. Good fruits. It is something that is beneficial. You know, fruit is karpos. Karpos, which means it originates from something. It is the work, the profit, the praise. You know, the fruits come when we, what, are seen as peaceable. When we literally do become highly, intensely reasonable. When we are willing to yield and help other people see that we are able to get out of the way. Or help them get out of their own way. And thus we seem to be full of mercy. And thus we are full of good fruits. Fruits are being visible expression of the power that works inwardly and invisible. You see it says in vines. The character of the fruit being evidence of the character of the power that produces it. You see, we don't get to claim the glory. We get to claim the access, the association. You see, when somebody says, wow, I just don't understand how you're always so upbeat, how you're loving and kind, how were you able to forgive that person? And we go, well, I've just been at it so long. You know, I've been a Christian for 50 years. I think I've practiced it enough. Is that what we feel? No. You and I quickly want to say, no, it's through God's power, his mercy. We get it because we're associated with him. It's that power that produces that result in us. You know, Matthew 7:16 talks about this. As the visible expression of the hidden lusts are the works of the flesh, so the invisible power of the Holy Spirit is in those who are brought into the living union with Jesus Christ. Something happens when we're with Christ. Something happens when we're with God. Something happens miraculously for those of you who do not have the full dwelling and measure of God's Spirit. Something happens in that clearing. Our conscience is cleansed, it says in Hebrews chapter 9, verse 14. To now do what? To do good works. What are those works and how are they done? James says it's here because it's knowledge applied through the understanding that we are connected with God and now it's he who must flow through us. And now it becomes what? It is pure. It is then peaceable. It's gentle. It's this intense ability to be reasoned with and to reason with others. It's willing to yield. It's full of mercy. And thus we have good fruits. I cite another comment from Vines because it's really powerful. And I think Galatians chapter 5, we talk about the fruit of the Holy Spirit. The word is translated in the singular for a reason, because the singular form suggests the unity of the character of the Lord that produces it. You see, the fruit that comes from a spiritual life is produced from what? From the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. God didn't sacrifice another son for you and another son for you. He sacrificed the life for you and me and everybody. And it's from that commonality, that common bond that we share, that place of purity, that then we get to sow these things, express them, practice them, and watch them build. And thus, when it says you have love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, that's what it looks like when you're a person of God and using His Spirit. Applying His knowledge from above, that seems to be like it's a gift from heaven to those who see it. Now here, the last two concepts are rather fascinating. It says, all of this comes full of mercy, good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Do you notice how it repeats the word without with both words? Once again, in the Greek, it's very artistic. Both words begin with an A. You know, you would remember this verse. It's the four E's and the two A's. You would have it memorized in the way in which it was presented, right? And so notice what he says, without partiality. It is without uncertainty that we apply these things. It is not to be parted with. It is without indecision. It's without wrangling, doubtfulness, or variance. Variance meaning, I'm going to be this way always. That's our goal. Our goal is to extend that reasonableness, that willingness to yield, that kindness, that love, that cannot come from just where we reside. It comes from where we reside in a purity with God. And once we have that place, then we are able and confident to extend that to others because we realize the power comes from God through us and thus can be embedded in the lives of the others. It is without partiality. We don't say, oh, I think I'll use it on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I think I'll use it on my good friends, but not on my bad friends. I think I'll use it on Aunt so-and-so, but not on Uncle Harry. No, we're striving to be impartial with it. Whether it be the person at the security gate at the bank, or whether it be the vice president of the bank, we want to engage them. And we practice that by saying hello and hi and how are you and learning their names in all stations of life. That's just a symbol of a minuteness. But we take from that place of purity, that place of confidence that God can extend mercy to all as He did to us. That's the beauty of the feast days. That's the power of the message we have, okay, that most of Christendom today cannot extend. You and I believe in the power of God to extend mercy to those who have lived in the past and are dead, those who are alive now, and those who will live in the future. We understand that all the people before the flood are not lost. All the people after the flood who have died are not lost. The Sodom and Gomorrites people aren't lost. That is a very unique place. We believe in that God who is that big, that pure, that loving, that caring, that kind. And it's from that place that you and I get to act and think and breathe in this way that James is talking about. And thus it says, without hypocrisy, anipokritos. It means unfeigned. It is undisguised. You know, interestingly, in the Greek, there's the word, the A part of this meaning the negative in Greek. If you put A in front of something, it means the negative. It means not, and it not means not in the other concept out of this word where it has the N. It means the euphonic, the acoustic effect of words, meaning, oh, what a lovely dress. That's not what we meant. We meant, well, it doesn't look very good. Right? That's the inflection I gave was I used the right words, but the wrong inflection, right? Wow, you look lovely in that dress. No, there's nothing unfeigned about that, right? There's nothing, fake. It's not hypocrisy. Thus, when we apply these things, we do them without hypocrisy, without being unfeigned, without being insincere, that we say of wisdom in our life that it has no hypocrisy, that because it's from above, it is incapable of being offered without a sincerity which represents the invisible character from the inside. I'll read that one again because I love it. Without hypocrisy means it is incapable of being offered without a sincerity which represents the invisible character from the inside. We want everything we say to come forward and through with an intensity that is so sincere that the person knows they're loved, knows they're cared for, knows that God is powerful, knows that we are a part of that God. We want that sincerity to be without hypocrisy, without any partiality, so that it reflects God. And all we are is a conduit. All we are, as it says here, we are people who it looks to the world around that we got wisdom that came from above naturally, when in fact we worked for it every thought, every day, every prayer, and said, God, I don't think I conveyed that right. I think I could do better. Please help me out of the way, and I'll think about that, and we'll apply those words next time a little better. And it looks like wisdom that came what? For you and I, it's first from above. It's pure. It's peaceable. It has an intense ability to be reasoned with, willing to yield, to find the ground on which people can see the mercy of God. And thus it looks like a whole tree of good fruits that are done without partiality and are sown without unfeigned meaning. You know, if we see back over verse 13, it says, who is wise? Who is wise and understanding among you? Who's wise and understanding in your family and mine around our dinner table? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. The meekness of wisdom. And why is meekness? Because, brethren, you and I know unless God had touched our life, unless God had forgiven our sin, unless God had put us in that safety place of purity, we could not extend love. We could not extend mercy. We could not yield without being unreasonable. We could not do it with unfeigned hypocrisy, because we look at our lives and we go, except God do this, I would never have done it on my own. And that is seen as meekness, because we know that wisdom that we now see in our lives is truly knowledge that came from above. It came from sowing peace, applying knowledge of God, and thus it looks to all around that we got a gift called the wisdom from above.